Well, the U.S. fan base, they want to see something they can rally around ahead of their trip to Qatar.
Oh, great ball from Zimmerman. Weston McKennie once again making the run. It's tremendous control by McKennie. Gets the shot away. Ferreira Areola couldn't get his foot around it.
Se despide con una derrota antes de viajar a Europa.
Desastroso segundo tiempo del equipo mexicano. No disparó ni una sola vez con dirección a portería.
America's live and underway here on ESPN Plus. Alongside Hercules Gomez, I'm Sebastian Salazar. Great to be with you as the last international break before the World Cup has come to a close. We are, Herc, now just 50 plus days away from the start of the World Cup in Qatar. How are you feeling?
I'm feeling good. I can't believe it's almost just 50 days till Qatar. There's so many questions to be asked, Seb. Oh, no.
Yes, especially for the teams that we cover. Actually, for most of CONCACAF, really.
All of CONCACAF.
For most of the world.
Except Canada.
We have only,
Canada.
A couple months. Yeah. Let's give Canada some love, as we always do on this show. We got lots coming on this edition of Football Americas. Taylor Twellman is waiting in the wings. He's going to join us in just a second. We're going to talk about the U.S. against Saudi Arabia, U.S. against Japan as well. Mauricio Pedrosa is going to join us as well as we talk about El Tri. Of course, they lost 3-2 against Colombia late on Tuesday night. Julie Foudy scheduled to join the program as we will discuss the U.S. women's national team roster that just dropped. Big games coming up against England and Spain. And Herc, we have a clue, a hint as to where the final of the 2026 FIFA World Cup may be played. But we'll leave that for later in the show. We're going to start
shameless
with the U.S. men's national team, who in their last match before the World Cup settled for a 0-0 draw against Saudi Arabia on Tuesday in Spain. This comes, of course, on the heels of a disappointing 2-0 loss to Japan last week. Now, unlike the game against Japan, Herc, this is very important, the U.S. did manage to get a shot on goal. Not just one shot on goal, two shots on goal.
There we go!
In the 0-0 draw against Saudi Arabia. That was the good news, maybe the good news. The bad news is that it was another game without a goal and another game without a win. Here's more reaction from Spain.
I think it's a mixed bag. I think there is a lot of frustration because we wanted to end on a little bit more of a positive note, get a result against the quality side. But, you know, it's understandable that there are probably some nerves in the group, probably guys who are anxious out there. But, you know, we gotta put that behind us. And the way that you make the team, the way that you get on the plane is by playing confident, playing up to your abilities and your standards. And we just weren't quite able to get everyone up to that level tonight.
I feel like in the final third, you know, we could have done more as a team, across the ball more. You know, there were some combinations that we could have been cleaner on, you know, but as a team, you know, we know we have to get better and just improve.
I'm not panicked at all. You know, we have a fresh slate going into the World Cup, and we're going to give it everything that we have, you know, those first three games in the group stage. And I know that we're going to do well. I think we have quality on the ball, but I think there's times where we can, you know, use our strengths a bit more and be sort of a nasty team to play against and just a difficult team to play against. I think we saw glimpses of that tonight. You know, in the midfield, we really want to dominate that battle for sure. And yeah, like I said, we're just going to continue to try to play more attacking and find ways to score goals.
I think, you know, if we're going to evaluate everybody, what I'd say in general, there's not many players that performed up to their normal levels in this camp. And that's just how it is. Yeah, I think we got some clarity. You know, we talked about it today with the group and with the coaching group. And, you know, I think things became pretty clear.
What became clear to you?
Things.
Things, people. For more on the U.S. men's national team and their recent performances against Saudi Arabia and Japan, we call on Taylor Twellman. Taylor, great to have you back with us here on Football Americas.
Yeah, great to be with you guys. How long do we have? 45 minutes? Hour?
Yes.
2 hours?
Yes. Well, we've got a lot of things to cover, as Greg Berhalter would say. Let's start there. What things did we learn about this U.S. men's national team? Not just the game against Saudi Arabia, but the game against Japan as well. Kind of what's your big takeaway, Taylor?
My biggest takeaway is all the concerns that all of us on the outside looking in had going into the final two games and ultimately to the World Cup. Those concerns are real. They're legitimate. Other than who's your goalkeeper? Matt Turner's your starting goalkeeper. That debate is over. He's won that position. I'd argue he won that position during qualifying, but that's neither here nor there. He's your starting goalkeeper. Who are the center back partnership? We don't know that answer. Who's the best three in the midfield? I don't think we know that answer with the way Weston McKennie played in this camp. And secondly, most importantly, I'd argue right now, we don't have anyone that can score goals. And when you think about that question, in the last 12 games, Herc and Seb, 8 of those 12, they did not score a single goal from open play. If you are not concerned about this team in the final third, then I'm not sure you've been paying attention for the last 18 months. That is probably my biggest concern and the biggest takeaway I had from these two games.
Yeah, a few things I learned. I learned health is a major issue with this generation. And when that health is tested, so is this team's ability to break down the following that we already knew, a low block. I knew that they struggled to generate any type of offense versus a low block, but all of a sudden Japan did it, and at times Saudi Arabia. Any team that presses you, all of a sudden you cough up the ball and you make it that easy for them to come right back down your throats. A few things I learned from the U.S. men's national team without going into further detail, because I'm sure we're going to talk a lot more about it right now.
Yeah, the things that we did learn, I think, are limited, right? We had some big questions that we needed answered. 9 center backs, we're going to talk about those in a little bit. Matt Turner's maybe the one thing you come out and you say, okay, clearly this is a guy who did what he needed to do in this moment to put at least one question mark to bed when it comes to this U.S. men's national team. To your point about health, Herc, I think really what you're talking about is depth, right? Because we all started scratching our heads when Greg Berhalter said, I got 5 starters missing. But I think what you see is that this team really struggles when it doesn't have its A team, right? It really is not a complete team. And that drop-off, and I think this is true across the midfield line and definitely the defensive line. Maybe we'll leave the front three out of it. But the drop-off from the starters to the next guy, to that number 2 guy on the depth chart, is very, very serious. And I think it's not just in terms of, you know, you don't have depth when it comes to maybe your 13th, 14th guys. You also don't have depth of stars. This team needs its stars to play well. It needs Christian Pulisic to play well. It needs Weston McKennie to play well. And what did we see in this window? We didn't see Pulisic a lot. I don't think he played particularly well when he was on the field. We definitely didn't see, to what the point Taylor makes, the best out of Weston McKennie. When those two guys aren't there and you got a Yunus Musah out, it's like, well, where's the goals? Where's the quality? Where's the star power? Like, this team didn't have a lot of answers. All right, let's move on to a phrase, Taylor, that you made famous 5 years ago next week. It's crazy to think it's been 5 years ago since "what are we doing" became part of the American soccer lexicon. But let's turn it to the U.S. national team here. What are we doing with the system? Because I've heard a lot of talk about Greg Berhalter's system. So how do we feel about his system now that we've seen it over the last two games?
I've had questions about the system from the beginning, because no matter what, and this isn't technically a Greg Berhalter issue, this is an issue in general. When you treat the national team like a club is treated where the system is bigger than the players, because you can go out and buy the players that fit your system, your style of play. When you have a national team, that's not the case. The players that are within your national team that are in their prime, they dictate the system that you play. And what we've seen from Greg Berhalter and his quote-unquote system on the road in CONCACAF World Cup qualifying and on the road in these kinds of games, they struggle. They do not score goals. They don't dominate possession. And I think Herc hit the nail on the head at the beginning of this. If you high press the U.S. team, they're actually worse than they are against the low blocks teams where they struggled in World Cup qualifying. So if you're Wales, if you're England, and if especially if you're Iran, if you watch the Japan game, be compact, high press, this team is going to shoot themselves in the foot and they have no chance of creating anything. That's why I question the system, and I've always questioned the system for any national team that's trying to treat this as if the system is bigger than the group of players that are available.
Say it louder for the people in the back, Taylor. The players on the national team dictate the system. The pool dictates the system. What we're seeing right here is the inability, and Taylor, you've spoken it many times, the plan B, when you get punched in the face. So you can't do the system with Walker Zimmerman and Aaron Long, players, center backs who you're asking them to come out cleanly with the ball and build out of the back, who necessarily don't do it week in and week out in a consistent basis like in New York and Nashville. That they don't do that, so don't ask them to that. Then you're going to put in a converted nine to facilitate other people instead of putting in a nine that you think is hot right now to score goals. No, you want to treat this system as if it's bigger than the players, and Taylor already said it, it's not.
Taylor?
Nope. And real quick, Herc, you know this better than anyone. The 2010 World Cup team changed. The trajectory of that team changed because Bob Bradley looked at it and said, you know what? I've got to play Clint Dempsey and Landon Donovan in positions where they're going to touch the ball more and they're going to be most effective. And that ended up being in wide areas for that team. That wasn't through the middle. So that's why the pool of players dictates what you do. And mind you, Herc, you and Seb talked about this on this program here. In World Cup qualifying, when the backs were against the wall, Greg Berhalter switched it a little bit. They were a little bit more direct. They high-pressed a little bit. They played into the profiles of their players. I think it behooves his staff to look at this in the 8 days before that Wales game where the entire group is together and say, I'm not so sure we need to try to do this philosophically the way we took over this job. I think it's in our best interest to play direct, to play active, and to play into the profiles of the center backs, the midfield, and most importantly, the front players. It wouldn't totally surprise me if he flips the script.
The biggest complaints about, like, the system for me have been how you're limited in player selection, right? Like, how do you have a system that at the end of the day leaves guys like Jordan Pefok out or John Brooks or whoever the guy that you want to mention? I might throw another complaint here in about the system. And Taylor, I wonder if you'll remember this from, like, early days, 2019, Berhalter's taking over. I feel like there were some concerns that the complexities of his system would be a challenge in terms of communicating that to guys in an international break when you got two or three games and you got to download.
Eric Williamson of Portland said it so himself.
And process all that stuff. I wonder if that's also an issue here, if maybe the complexity of the system, or better said, Berhalter's ability to explain it to the guys and then have them execute might also be a problem here when it comes to the system. Not just the fact that it eventually like limits the guys that you might actually call in. All right, our next what are we doing is a position that you gentlemen are both very, very familiar with. What are we doing when it comes to the starting number nine position? Taylor Twellman, what do you think? We saw Jesus Ferreira get one start. We saw Ricardo Pepi get another start. We saw some Josh Sargent off the bench. What are we doing at the starting number nine?
I'd argue the player stock that rose the most in the last two games is Jordan Pefok. I'd make that argument with anyone because the truth of the matter is the three players that were in there didn't do enough. Now, Herc, you've known me long enough. Seb, you've worked with me long enough. If my number nine in Jesus Ferreira is dropping deep into the midfield and trying to get the ball 5 yards off of Tyler Adams, I'm going to blow a gasket. I'm going to lose my mind because then the two center backs of the opposition have absolutely nothing to do. And if your wide players aren't doing their job and playing vertical, it's the easiest job to defend that. Josh Sargent is in great form with the club. He only got 4 minutes in these two games. But I look at this profile of Jesus Ferreira, and I understand he's coming off a career year in MLS. I get all of that. I totally understand it. But I don't want my center forward dropping deep into the midfield. Ricardo Pepi's got one goal in his last 11 months. 11 months! And you've got a guy that is in the Bundesliga with 3 goals, 3 assists for one of the top 2 teams in the league, and he's not part of your 26. You will never, ever, ever convince me otherwise that that player right there can't be of benefit to you. And I honestly believe that coaching staff right now is looking at each other in the room going, we're really not going to do this? We're really going to keep that guy home? It can't happen, and it shouldn't happen.
Let me play devil's advocate for a second. Greg Berhalter's system is a fire extinguisher for in-form forwards. It's what it is, because they're trying to live off scraps. You're asking guys like Ricardo Pepi, who are finishers, or when they're in their form, are finishers, to go into the midfield, as you said, and then try to come off 7 or 8 touches and feel like you can be effective on the field. Jesus Ferreira, to his credit, at least got a shot off, though I don't believe he's an effective forward. You're asking a converted 9 to do other things so other players can be good or can be better. A Christian Pulisic, a Brendan Aaronson, a Giovanni Reyna, so they could be dangerous. The issue here isn't Jordan Pivak, whether I'd like to admit it or not. It's this system and what they ask of these 9s. Now, Jordan Pivak should be on this flight. Jordan Pivak is currently an informed goal scorer that you don't find, who has added the ability to facilitate others into his game at the highest of levels of the Bundesliga. You know this better than I. You were in the exact same position in 2006. You were the informed striker, the guy that everybody wanted on the national team. Your goals, day in, day out, week in, week out, were screaming for Bruce Arena to take you, and you weren't there. You know what this is like, Taylor. This has got to be killing Jordan Pivak and probably the other forwards, putting pressure on them too.
All right, very quickly, because I got to get a straight answer out of both of you on this. First game against Wales, the forward that gives the U.S. the best chance to win that game is Herc?
Josh Sargent, because he's the, if you want to go to a compromise of what Greg Berhalter asks and the abilities he can give you, he's the direct compromise.
Taylor, you agree?
I do agree, mainly because the pedigree of the player that he's going up against is more than likely going to be the same pedigree he's going up against in the championship week in and week out. And so he's going to have an understanding of how to play against the Welsh defender. So I think Herc hits the nail on the head. Do I think that's going to be the answer? No, I don't. I think Jesus Ferreira and this profile of being mobile and flexible and pulling off, that's what Greg's going to look at. But I think Herc's right. I think of those 3 players that we just saw, I think Josh Sargent's your best.
Yeah. Why not take 4? You got 26 spots this year. Why not take 4? I keep coming back to that. We talk about it with Mexico and with the U.S. There's 3 spots for seemingly
forward.
You don't
have to start Jordan Pivak, but he does have to come in the game.
Why not just take a 4th? Okay, our final, what are we doing? We go from the front to the back. Let's discuss another important position, center backs. We saw Aaron Long and Walker Zimmerman start both of the games over this international window. Taylor, what are we doing in the center of the American defense?
I think the issue with the center back partnership actually has a lot to do with, and I know Herc's going to talk about this as well, the system. I don't think the strengths and weaknesses of the 2 center backs that we saw against Japan and Saudi Arabia are suited for playing out of the back, are suited of playing under pressure. Are they athletic? Are they good in the air? Can they defend? Absolutely. But how many silly, sloppy giveaways did we see from Aaron Long and Walker Zimmerman, and I would throw Weston McKennie in there as well, in particular in the Japan game, where there's very little pressure in decision-making there and options, and the ball's just coughed up. And so, again, I go back to my original statement. If I'm Wales, if I'm England, and if I'm Iran, and I watch that Japan game, I'm immediately allowing the goalkeeper to roll it out to Zimmerman, to roll it out to Aaron Long, and then I am going to hound them. I'm going to get after them like a pack of wolves and turn them over and get going the other way. Because the other part is, you're not having to worry about the direct ball going forward because the United States doesn't want to play that, and their number 9's coming in. The 2 center backs right now, I think, would be better suited in a more simplified idea and system of play. And that way, it plays into the strengths of who they are and not ultimately what their weaknesses are. And I think the Miles Robinson injury is massive, because what we've seen from Greg Berhalter is he doesn't want to call in John Brooks. And the moment Chris Richards went down, Cameron Carter-Vickers went down, Tim Ream doesn't get a call, that tells you right now where Tim Ream is on the pecking order. And he's playing every single minute and every single week in the best league in the world. And so I just think if you're going to tell me it's Zimmerman and Long, I think I would change the philosophy, because it doesn't suit either center back.
Yeah, I won't talk about the partnership of Zimmerman and Long, because you've stressed that enough right there. And I'm with you there. I will say Chris Richards and Walker Zimmerman give you the best combination of physicality and technical ability that complement each other.
Yes.
And maybe you can get away with playing out of the back because you have Chris Richards to an extent. And I think people get the wrong idea with Walker Zimmerman. Walker Zimmerman actually can be very beneficial playing out of the back if you play to his ability of switching a ball. He's got a penchant for playing that long ball and really putting it on your foot. Against Morocco, he put Christian Pulisic on a dime. A few times where he found Weston McKennie. Weston McKennie bad touches, led him backwards instead of forwards into goal. He has that penchant for that switch. It could be a good combination of strength, physicality, and technical ability with that athleticism that protects you in from behind.
I feel like everybody's kind of holding their breath for Chris Richards, right? Everybody wants to see him get healthy and maybe take that spot that right now we've seen Aaron Long next to Walker Zimmerman. We know how Herc feels about John Brooks. Every episode here on Football America, we get Herc talking about John Brooks, how much he misses him on the national team. I'll throw Tim Ream into that discussion as well. Those are two guys with obviously huge resumes, Taylor. When we talk about the center backs, do you think one of or either of those guys, both of those guys, should be in the conversation? I think specifically Brooks, right? Brooks is a guy that we've talked about for a long time on this show.
It's an interesting discussion, because naturally you look at it and say John Brooks is playing where he is. He's playing against quality competition week in and week out. So how do you leave a guy out like that? Now, differently than PFOLK is this. All three of us have seen a lot of John Brooks with the U.S. men's national team. We know who he is. We know his last appearance against Honduras was one of the worst appearances of his professional career. And so I can buy into that. I also can buy in, if you want to sell me, Tim Ream's national team career has been underwhelming at best. But here's the argument for both Brooks and Ream. Nobody ahead of them right now is dominating. Nobody ahead of them in the pecking order is playing on a regular basis at the highest of levels, and most importantly, understanding what the job is. And so that's why I look at it and say, the Mark McKenzie's of the world, the Eric Palmer Browns of the world. Okay, they're playing. Yeah, I get it. But are they playing anywhere any much better than John Brooks or Tim? Like, the Tim Ream thing for me is very difficult to understand. Herc knows this. At the World Cup, you need players that are versatile. Anthony Robinson's out with an injury. He starts left back for Fulham in the Premier League, guys. So I just look at it and say, if you give me four center backs that are playing, I have no problem leaving Brooks and Ream at home based on where their national team careers have been. But guys, you know as well as I do, no one's dominating the center back position other than I would say Walker Zimmerman has put his footprint in saying, all right, I'm the leader, I'm going to go. Everyone else is in the same boat.
Yeah, but Greg Berhalter has told us he wants to play with the high line. I don't see him playing the high line at the World Cup. I actually see the U.S. men's national team being pinned in a lot. What I will stress is your most experienced player, not just defender, most experienced player on the national team is going to be DeAndre Yedlin. It's going to be his second World Cup. At some point, you're going to need experience, because experience brings that calm. And we heard Greg Berhalter after the game say maybe the guys are worried, or maybe they're stressed about not making the team. If they are nervous right now in an empty stadium on neutral ground versus Japan and Saudi Arabia, what's it going to be like versus England when it's packed, versus Wales when it's packed, versus Iran when you have geopolitical pressure on you?
Sure. To your point about experience, Chris Richards doesn't have much.
I couldn't agree. I couldn't agree more.
Caps, but yeah. All right, that's all the time we've got. Taylor, thanks for joining us here on Football America. It's great to have you with us on the show. Safe travels to your next MLS assignment. I know you got LAFC and Portland coming up on the weekend.
See you, boys.
There he is, Taylor Twellman. We got some more U.S. news. Gio Reyna's out. I hate these. Up to 10 days after picking up a muscle strain while on international duty, the 19-year-old was subbed off at the 30-minute mark on Tuesday. Herc, maybe those back-to-back starts weren't such a great idea.
Oh, man, I'm getting John O'Brien vibes. If you're a New Age soccer
fan... Don't do it. Don't do that to Gio.
If you don't know who John O'Brien is, look him up. This man was a menace. This man was so good technically. Such a high ceiling. Please, please, baby Jesus, don't let this happen.
Edin Terzic, who is, of course, Borussia Dortmund's manager, said he hopes Reyna can return after the Sevilla game, which they'll play Sevilla in Champions League next Wednesday. So far this season, just 247 minutes of club action for Reyna with Borussia Dortmund. There you see some of the stats over his last three seasons in the Bundesliga. Gio Reyna, again, out up to 10 days after picking up a muscle strain on international duty. Don't forget, ESPN Plus is the home of the Bundesliga. We got a huge game on Saturday. Bayern Munich, the defending champs, who right now sit fifth and are not off to a great start, against a team that's really struggling. Bayer Leverkusen, 15th in the table. Coverage starts 2:30 p.m. Eastern time on Saturday. Don't miss it.
Tired of ads interrupting your favorite sports podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music, included with your Prime membership. Amazon Music offers the most ad-free top podcasts. Enjoy shows like First Take, Pardon the Interruption, and The Low Post, available ad-free and uninterrupted. To start listening, download the Amazon Music app or go to amazon.com/ESPNpods. That's amazon.com/ESPNpods to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hi, this is ESPN's Mike Greenberg, and ESPN Bet is ready to take you through all the biggest sports moments this spring. The official sports book of ESPN has exclusive offers and markets from Scott Van Pelt, Stephen A. Smith, and me. From the upcoming draft, the playoff intensity, and finally getting out to the ballpark, there's no better time for sports fans. Sign up today, and new users get $100 in bonus bets for making any sports book bet. Download ESPN Bet today. What a play.
Must be 21 plus and present in select states. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Terms and conditions apply. See app for details.
Tata Martino then making headlines for his post-game comments after Mexico lost 3-2 against Colombia on Saturday. Joining us for more, Mauricio Pedrosa. Mau, welcome back to the show. Great as always to have you.
Glad to be here, guys.
Okay, so real quick, let's recap kind of what Tata Martino said there for those who weren't following along in the subtitles. He talked about Mexican soccer being peculiar. He complained about Mexican players not leaving the domestic league. He talked about the league not maybe being in service of the national team. And he, of course, talked about Mexican football's many past frustrations. It didn't have much to do with the game. Mau, is it time for Tata Martino to get lost for his post-match comments?
I mean, would the real Tata Martino please stand up, right? Where was this guy a year ago, a year and a half, 2 years ago? This is no news for everyone who has been involved in Mexican soccer in recent history. There's no news whatsoever. This is exactly how Mexican soccer operates. And now to the final part of his statement, where he's complaining that the league doesn't do any favors to the Mexican national team, I want to ask Gerardo Martino, what league around the world is focused around their national team and not their own business? That's not the way it works. So I think he should completely get lost. Now, going back to the first part of his statement, I think there's a lot that we can actually talk about, but I will focus on just this one thing. Gerardo Martino is the Mexican national team manager so that the team, the individuals, the players progress, do better, improve as a team. So if Colombia, in the span of 15 minutes, is going to turn the game around, there's a portion of blame for the players, but there's also a big part of the blame for the manager, Gerardo Martino. And I didn't hear him also criticizing himself because obviously he was not going to do it. He should get lost.
Ooh, you came feisty today.
Yeah, it's been a while since I've been here, so yeah, I have things to say.
To your question, it's also the responsibility of the league because each ownership group has a say in how the national team is run, much like the FA in England. So, yes, and also, did he lie? Did he say anything that was... No, he didn't. He didn't. So there's some validity there. But you know where it doesn't count? That's not why they lost to Colombia. That's not why Mexico has been struggling in this window. That's not why... And you gave him 15 minutes. I would have said 7-8 minutes. They turned that game around in the first half. We joked about it before it went on air, which is the Colombia legends. Falcao and James Rodriguez is pretty much their going away party, if you will. Listen, this is vintage right now. Tata Martino going at the press, and what we've seen since Gerardo Torrado's dismissal. He is on a mission. He is 2 seconds away from going nuclear and airing out all the dirty laundry come Qatar.
Look, what he says, I don't think maybe he could get lost for, but the timing of it, absolutely. This is something that you say, as you mentioned, now a year ago, a year and a half ago, or even when you took the job. These are kind of day one issues that he's talking about that he should have been complaining about 2-3 years ago as part of this buildup. Not now. Not now, 50 days until the World Cup. We talk about him being already 1 foot out the door. I think he's already 1 foot of them going out in the group phase. Like, he already sounds like a guy who's not just half gone, but very much half defeated. Yeah. This does not, to me, sound like a guy who's inspiring confidence either in his group, in terms of the technical staff, the team, and obviously not with the fan base or anybody else that watches this team. The other reason that I hate the timing of this, Mal, and I just want to get your perspective here, because I know Herc is just waiting for the L3 crash and burn at the World Cup. But for maybe who's somebody, for somebody who wants to see maybe Mexico succeed, this kind of covers up what were 45 very good minutes and the best minutes we've seen from Mexico since pre-pandemic. Now, there are other teams that we've already talked about in this show, like the U.S., that didn't even get 45 good minutes. Should there be some optimism, at least, for Mexico fans based on what they saw against Colombia in that first half?
I think there should be some optimism by the fans, right? By those who want to see the team do well. But at the same time, you wonder, is this because of great decisions by Gerardo Martino, or is it because the players are good enough that in a good day, they will give you good 45 minutes? Not because of what has happened inside of the Mexican national team, just because they are good enough players that given a good situation, they can perform really well. Now, the question is, why can you sustain the next 45 minutes to this level? And Gerardo Martino in that very same press conference said, there's no team in this world that can play for 90 minutes like we did for 45. And he's right. The problem is we haven't seen this in a long time. I think if you were checking social media during the game, I think the common comment was, it's been a while. It's been a long time.
Yes.
Where has this been team? Where has this team been in the past 2 years? So unfortunately, it feels like this was the exception to the rule.
Can I give you a, quick just parallel between the two coaches on the two main national teams or the two front runners, if you will, historically in this region? It's Tata Martino starts off well, doesn't make in-game adjustments. He is terrible at that. Greg Berhalter starts off terribly, makes good in-game adjustments. It's crazy to see the parallels between these two teams.
Okay, so if you put them together, if you Frankenstein it, we might have a great manager there at the international level.
Manager.
All right, let's get to three questions. And let's start with our first question, which has to do with formations. Now, guys, we've seen a lot of Mexico in a 4-3-3 under Tata Martino. But recently, we're seeing a little bit of a change to a 4-2-3-1. Mal, is this the formation Mexico should go with at the World Cup?
Only against Argentina. And here is why. If you're going to play a 4-2-3-1, that means you're going to have two holding midfielders. Against Colombia in the first half, those two holding midfielders were Eric Gutierrez and Andres Guardado. You're going to have to play somehow Edson Alvarez into that equation. Now, I think they played really well next to each other. Andrés Guardado playing more like a traditional number six, and then Eric Gutierrez being this link between defending and attacking. And I think if you're gonna play Argentina, a team that's gonna dominate possession, you need numbers in the midfield. So I think that formation makes a lot of sense. What is the downside? If you play with three attacking midfielders, you need a classic number 10. Bad news for Mexico, you don't have one. Mm. You don't have Cuauhtémoc Blanco. You've mentioned Carlos Vela in this example. So you cannot start against Poland with a 4-2-3-1 because then you're playing reactive. And Mexico needs to have the ball if they want to hurt a team like Poland who plays more a direct attack kind of soccer. So the answer is he should change it only against Argentina.
Here's the reason you won't see it versus Argentina, or he won't change it. His name is Edson Álvarez. The only reason there was two pivots and Andrés Guardado was one of them is because Edson Álvarez is not on the field. So Andrés Guardado was the man dropping in between both center backs, Néstor Araujo and Héctor Moreno. That was his job, to play as a deep line playmaker, if you will, with Guti a little ahead of him and Charlie as that enganche, that number 10 that Mal was talking about. But when you have Edson Álvarez there, there's no need for Guardado. He's just a liability. So if you're going to go with Edson Álvarez, you need two interiors that can also give you that movement up and down the field. Guardado's not going to be that guy. So in the game that Mao is saying you will least have the ball, you're going to put in a guy like Andrés Guardado in a function to run and chase the ball?
What if you play as Edson Álvarez in that spot, and then you play Eric Gutierrez like he did during those first 45 minutes against Colombia, and then you have Chari Rodriguez in front of him and two wingers, right? I think that formation makes sense.
Except for Tata Martino, who is going to have Héctor Herrera there.
Wow. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's the thing, right? That's my concern, Herc, because you always talk about it being a young man's game at the international level. I think you got to figure out a way to have Héctor Herrera have his role, Andrés Guardado have his role. I don't know if you can have them on the field together. We've seen that a little bit in a 4-3-3. I don't think there's enough legs in that midfield. I like the idea of the 4-2-3-1. I like what you point out, Mal, which is the numerical advantage. I think having an extra guy in midfield could be very beneficial to Mexico. And the other thing I would say is, hey, it's finally some flexibility from Tata, right? We said he's stubborn. We said he won't change his mind. Well, maybe here's a little bit of something that shows he can be flexible. All right, next on our three questions. Next on our three questions. Is it time to bench Chucky Lozano in favor of what they're calling El Tridente Olímpico, featuring Alexis Vega, Uriel Antuna, and Henry Martin, who, of course, we saw get the start against Colombia? Mal, what say you? Chucky to the bench?
Can I say hell no on TV?
Yes, you can absolutely say that to this. 100%.
Hell no! No way! What are you talking about? You have to start Chucky Lozano. He is right now, the only player in that attacking trio that can actually perform at a top level, because he plays internationally. He plays in Italy for Napoli. I know we are all in love with Alexis Vega. I am in love with Alexis Vega. I think I even changed my mind from the last time that I was here when we asked who should start in Tecatito Corona's place, and I said Diego Lainez. Fine, I changed my mind. That one has to be Alexis Vega. But you cannot bench Chucky Lozano, especially for a very average player like Uriel Antuna. If you all remember who Jürgen Damm was, Uriel Antuna is the exact same thing. Fast dude whose crosses are questionable and doesn't truly defend. So, no, the answer, very passionate answer, it is no. You have to start Chucky Lozano, Alexis Vega, and, yeah, sure, Henry Martin.
Uriel Antuna is one of the most productive players when he puts on that green shirt.
Oh, my gosh. We're leaning on statistics from 2019. Here we go.
Yeah, here's the thing. You want another stat? Chucky Lozano has scored one goal in the last 8 months. You want another stat? I would go as far as saying El Tridente Olímpico over El Tridente that they used in World Cup qualifying. Raul Jimenez, Tecatito Corona, and Chucky Lozano, because they were pitiful, because they were terrible, they were bad. They scored one goal between the three of them as a penalty kick, okay, when they were on the field together. They are names. They're not a team. You've seen, and I don't like using U23 tournaments as an example, but El Tridente Olímpico, you saw in the first half how important they were versus a team like Colombia.
Who were they playing against? Who were they playing against?
Colombia. I just said like a team versus Colombia. Colombia.
No, yeah, but I'm saying that under-23 team, do you think that's exactly the standard
that we have to use to measure the attacking trio? And this is the most important thing, because you are 52 days away from the World Cup. You have today.
Yeah.
Because you're not talking about the Raul Jimenez version of yesterday. You're not talking about Tecatito Corona of yesterday. You're not talking about Chucky Lozano, who scored against Germany and Russia. You're talking about their play today. Okay. Chucky Lozano doesn't play today.
So you think Antuna's momentum is better than Chucky Lozano's?
No, but you're mentioning the three, El Tridente.
Yeah.
And yes, I would say the A3 work better and Chucky Lozano on the field.
No, come on. I'll give you Henry Martin.
Yeah.
I'll give you Alexis Vega.
Yeah.
But I will not give you Uriel Antuna. We were at the skills challenge. We broadcast the skills challenge.
Well, Murphy, that shouldn't be on the field.
You remember Uriel at the skills challenge?
Stop.
All right. All right, final question here on this edition of Three Questions with Mauricio Pedrosa. Let's focus on the defense. Who will be Mexico's center back pairing? Now, Mal, last week you said it was going to be Johan Vasquez.
And then
in these two games, he gets the big, fat, hairy, ugly DNP, did not play. So what do you think it'll be?
last week, I told you who I would start.
Yes.
Now the question is who will start? And I have to go with Cesar Montes and Hector Moreno, because that is clearly Tata Martino's favorite pairing at center back for the Mexican national team. I disagree. I think you have to start either Néstor Araujo or Johan Vázquez.
Now you said Araujo and Vázquez last week. This is totally the opposite of what you want.
Totally the opposite. And I'm just a commentator. Tata Martino is a very experienced manager who probably knows more football than me. Fine. But I just have to go with what I see. And what I see is recently, Cesar Montes has barely played. And if you go back, because let's remember, Cesar Montes and Hector Moreno are teammates in Monterrey. Víctor Manuel Bucetich doesn't even think that's their best pair at center back at his own club. Yet, Gerardo Martino, for some reason, believes they are. Again, I would start Néstor Araujo and Johan Vázquez. That's only me. And the fact that Johan Vázquez played 0 minutes in the last international break tells me everything I need to know of what Tata Martino thinks of him. But I would still insist that Néstor Araujo, right now, 30 years old, he's the best center back in the best club in the Mexican League right now. He should start next to, and this is just resignation, Hector Moreno.
Cesar Montes is the best center back Mexico has today. Johan Vázquez may be the biggest name that everybody was excited about at the U23 level, and then he made a Serie A move, and everybody was still excited about him and kept clamoring and yelling and exigiendo Tata Martino bringing Johan Vázquez. But the reality is, Tata Martino doesn't care for Johan Vázquez. He played very little in World Cup qualifying. In fact, the very few times he did play were Mexico's worst moments. Moments against Canada, moments against the U.S. That was when Johan Vázquez was on the field. So he doesn't have that equity built in with Tata. That's not what I feel. That's what Tata has shown us. That's what we've seen because Johan Vázquez doesn't get on the field. Who do we want to see? It doesn't matter. Because the reality is, I would love to see, I know they're different profiles, but I would love to see Néstor Araujo and Cesar Montes. I think as Mao stated, we're going to get Hector Moreno and Cesar Montes. The profiles are very important, even though he's not even asking these guys to play out of the back cleanly. He's going to drop in Edson Álvarez or Guardado, as we saw versus Colombia. But at some point, the leadership of Moreno, the aerial ability, and Cesar Montes' physical attributes, when you are stuck and pinned in behind the likes of Poland and Argentina, are going to come into play.
All right, I actually agree with Herc here for once. I think Cesar Montes is, for me, the best of the lot by far. I think he should definitely start. I have never had a huge amount of faith in Araujo. And actually, based on what we saw from Hector Moreno over the last two games, I saw some character, some leadership, some yelling at guys. So I feel like maybe that's something that Mexico needs.
He can yell from the bench. That's fine. He can scream from the bench. Same effect.
So there we have a big question mark for Tata Martino as we focus in on the center of the Mexican defense. All right, that's all the time we've got, Mal. Thanks for joining us here on Football Americas. As always, great to have you with
us. Gracias, amigos.
And don't forget, we got the last weekend of the season coming up in Liga MX. Top game on Saturday on ESPN Plus and ESPN Deportes. A top four showdown. Second place, Rayados against third place, Pachuca.
Picture this. You arrive at your hotel. You have an important online meeting lined up with clients from all across the country. You have your laptop open, ready to begin, and The Wi-Fi is so terrible, you can't even connect. These types of stressful situations happen all the time, but they don't have to. When you book a room at La Quinta by Wyndham, you have access to their free high-speed Wi-Fi, so you can take care of those critical emails, join your meetings on time, and even unwind by streaming your favorite shows without having to worry. Tonight, La Quinta. Tomorrow, you shine. Book direct at LQ.com.
10 seconds on the clock. How many things can you name that are always growing? Your relationships, your skills, your customer base. How about businesses on Shopify? Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage, to the first real life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/network, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/network now to grow your business. No matter what stage you're in, shopify.com/network.
Okay, Herc, some big news here. Our colleague John Sutcliffe over at ESPN Deportes is reporting that Dallas will get the 2026 World Cup Final. Well, actually, Arlington, Texas, not quite Dallas. AT&T Stadium, a.k.a. Jerry's World. We've heard SoFi Stadium in Los Angeles is a possibility, MetLife Stadium in New Jersey, but the early reports say Dallas, although folks in charge of the Dallas bid are saying that the reporting is premature. So, Herc, what do you think? Are you cool with it, the 2026 World Cup Final to be played at Jerry's World?
Seriously? I mean, there are people in Texas, in the Dallas-Fort Worth area, in Arlington, who are scratching their heads. Public transportation, it's pretty much impossible to get to the stadium unless you have a car. So you're going to have all these tourists from all around the world and no public transportation. You have two meccas, like Los Angeles and the New York, New Jersey surrounding areas. Insert your joke, if you will, there. I know, Meadowlands, whatever you want. That would suffice. I understand climate may be an issue. Field dimensions in the other. But if you've already cleared both, you're going to take it to Arlington, to Jerry's World, where they could expand to 105, and I would assume that's why they're doing this. I would assume Jerry Jones and that conglomerate over there has something to say, and that's why it's going there, per the reporting. This is still very premature, and I hope it's not the case. I am still very much vying for Los Angeles.
Look, I grew up in Washington, so you know I can't be pro-Dallas, like, too hard and keep my D.C. card here. I can't believe Jerry Jones is going to get a World Cup final, dude. I just, like, what has Jerry Jones ever done for soccer? Well, he's had the Mexican national team come through Jerry's World a couple times so he could make some money. Like, please, what has Jerry Jones ever done for soccer? The one maybe redeeming thing about it being in Dallas is, you know, the Hunt family's done a lot for soccer. I think this has a lot more to do with them than maybe Jerry Jones. I'm not crazy about it, Herc. I'm not crazy about it. I'm not super cool with it being in Dallas. Even a guy like, and I can't believe I'm actually going to do this, even a guy like Stan Kroenke, Herc, who owns your beloved Colorado Rapids, owns Arsenal, has poured millions, maybe billions of dollars into soccer.
Into real estate. Oh, I'm sorry, you said soccer.
Yes, and has a better stadium, by the way. I think we both agree, SoFi ahead of AT&T, right?
Yeah, I mean, I've never been to AT&T, but I've been plenty of times to SoFi.
SoFi's better than AT&T, for sure. I would rather see LA and SoFi get it than Dallas and AT&T. But either way, I'm sure it'll be a great event there. The 2026 World Cup
we'll be
final,
there.
We shall see. Speaking, Herc, of big events, we got one coming next February. The LA Galaxy and LAFC will open their 2023 MLS seasons against each other at the Rose Bowl. Scheduled for February 25th, it'll kick off the campaign for both teams. We know Charlotte FC set the single game regular season attendance record earlier this season, just short of 75,000. So the new question is this: will next February's El Tráfico at the Rose Bowl break that record and get up over 75,000 in attendance? Herc, what do you think?
I think so. Game one, yeah. That rivalry, yeah. LA is very much a football mecca. We saw what Leagues Cup did at SoFi.
Yes, we did.
A lot of those fans, those America fans, those Chiva fans that packed that stadium, underneath those jerseys, Galaxy and LAFC jerseys. There is no sporting event where these people do not come out for. I've seen, for the most irrelevant of games, this stadium get packed. And I'm not talking about UCLA, I'm not talking about football, I am talking about...
Moleros.
I was at a Mexico versus Cuba. A lot of those fans, many of those fans, believe it or not, do support LAFC, do support the Galaxy. That is a big rivalry here within California, within Los Angeles. And I do think it is achievable.
Yeah.
The marketing buzz behind it is big too. I got my rose, I got my newspaper sent to my house. Thank you to whoever sent it. It's going to happen.
Wow, it's going to happen. So you say more than 75,000. We've seen this before, right? With like the Cali Clasico, with LA Galaxy and San Jose, they've gotten over 50,000 plenty of times for that game. So you know there's a formula here at play that I think both these teams will do well to lean on. I wouldn't be surprised if it breaks the attendance record, Herc. I guess the bigger question here is, do you think it will sell out the Rose Bowl, which is a capacity 90,000? Because that wouldn't just be breaking the record. That'd be breaking the record by more than 15,000 fans. That'd be significant.
What date is it? February?
February 25th. First game of the season. You got months to sell tickets.
There will be no more NFL. Super Bowl will be over. There'll be no more college football. That's not started yet. Yeah.
It'll be tough. 90,000 would be
I think you could do it.
You think so?
Yeah.
Okay. Either way, 90,000 would be a very, very impressive number for a Major League Soccer regular season match. Speaking of LAFC, they are in action on Sunday, Herc, against the Portland Timbers. We got one team chasing the shield, another team trying to hold on to their playoff spot out there in the Western Conference. It's LAFC against the Portland Timbers, Sunday on ABC and ESPN Deportes.
The 2024 NFL Draft heads to Detroit, and it's time to see who gets the job.
Caleb is a unique and special talent throwing the football.
And what sets them apart.
The Heisman Trophy winner is Jaden Daniels.
All of the greats were hired here.
What a throw by Mahomes.
See who gets the job.
Are you ready?
The 2024 NFL Draft begins Thursday, April 25th on ESPN, ABC, and NFL Network.
U.S. Women's National Team manager Vlatko Andonovski has named a 24-player roster for upcoming friendlies against England and Spain. The headlines, Alex Morgan is out with a knee injury. Crystal Dunn returns for her first full call-up, easy for me to say, since giving birth. Other regulars, Becky Sauerbrunn, Lindsay Horan, Rose Lavelle, Megan Rapinoe are all in the team. Joining us for further reaction, two-time World Cup and Olympic champion Julie Foudy. Julie, been forever since we had you here on Football America. It's great to have you back. I see you're well and recovered from the Little League World Series, huh?
Barely. I've missed you guys.
I
don't have my Zoom return on, but I understand you might be wearing a very cool jersey.
You know I'm wearing a shirt. It's a little baseball tee, Angel City. You know it.
There it is.
Let's go, Sebby.
I made it to an Angel City game as well, which was awesome. So you guys have the Football America's team entirely covered here when it comes to the National Women's Soccer League. Let's focus in on the U.S., though. We got some big news here. Alex Morgan out. Julie, what kind of impact is this on the national team, especially with some really good competition coming up? And who do you think steps up and takes advantage of these minutes that are now available?
Yeah, I it's always a big impact when you miss a player like Alex Morgan, and especially the way Alex Morgan's been playing in NWSL, leading the entire league and scoring a lot of goals and playing with a lot of confidence. So for her, you feel the pain a bit because these are two games as a player, you're like, oh my gosh, I'd give anything to play in these games. And this injury won't allow that to happen. However, it does provide an opportunity for Ashley Hatch to get some time in the nine. And as we've been seeing in the NWSL, Sophia Smith plays in the nine for Portland often. And so maybe she slides into the middle. And honestly, every time you have a good player down, we always say it's an opportunity for another player to step up. And so it's a good test for Hatch and for that front line to deal without an Alex Morgan in the lineup.
No Alex Morgan, but Crystal Dunn is back in. How important of a player is she for Vlatko and this U.S. team, Julie?
Yeah, Herc, huge, huge. Donner gives energy and charisma. And I mean, you could see it in Vlatko Andonovski in the last camp. He said to us before the game, he said, just having Crystal back, she comes dancing into the locker room. She's full of joy. And I think honestly, that veteran leadership, that energy is something that with a young group you need and you want to see. And so I think they're thrilled to see her back, getting some time, NWSL time, and doing well, I mean, by all accounts. So I think it's great news for her to be back there and for the team. They love having her in the locker room and on the field.
Yeah, long absence there for Crystal Dunn. We saw a lot of Emily Fox at left back. I thought she played pretty well, but I think it's still, at least clearly for now, Crystal Dunn's position. She is one of the best players in the world for a reason, certainly at that left back spot, and really anywhere you put her, as we see in the National Women's Soccer League. All right, there's one other player on this roster, Julie, that I think when we first got the list really jumped out at everybody. That's Alyssa Thompson. She is just 17 years old. She's the youngest call-up that we've had in over 5 years. What can you tell us about this player, and maybe what's the timeline where we might see her develop and become a part of this senior national team?
Yeah, and think about this. Born in 2004. That's the year I retired. That's when she was born, which is crazy. Aaron Heifetz, the press officer, said to me today that Alyssa is closer in age to Alex's daughter, Charlie, than she is to Becky and Megan Rapinoe. I was like, wow. You said it, I didn't. So, 17-year-old who is here in Southern California. She plays on an under-17 MLS Next boys team, to give you some perspective of how good she is. And she played on the under-20 team. She played at the under-20 World Cup. She had a goal and an assist, but she's got pace. She's fast. We know she can score a lot of goals. We've seen her do it at the youth national team level. And clearly, I think this is a situation where this is an up-and-coming star who's maybe not there yet, of course, at 17, but it had to have been a decision, I imagine, for Vlatko Andonovski and his staff of weighing, okay, Midge Purse, for example, who plays in that right wing position. Alyssa's a winger. Do we know what we can get from Midge? Midge hasn't, as Vlatko Andonovski said in his presser today, hasn't been top form. She's taken a dip in form. Her team, Gotham, hasn't been playing that well. Well, that's an understatement. Hasn't been playing well at all. So he said, it's a chance for me to look at another player. And it's a chance, hopefully, for Midge Purse to reset and get back in there. But I think it's actually an interesting move. I like it. I like the idea of, okay, we're still 8 months out from having to name a World Cup roster. And if we are going to look, it's going to be very selective now. They're going to start honing in on that full roster. But here's a player that seems to be special by all accounts and is doing very well.
Well, let's talk expectations. Sebi over here keeps telling me the U.S. women are still the best in the world. But there's no Alex Morgan going into next week, and they're playing away against England and away against Spain. Do you still see them as favorites, Julie?
I don't see them as favorites against England. I mean, going into Wembley, sold out, as we know, it sold out in 24 hours or less. European Championships, who are on form, on a high, very confident, is going to be a tough challenge, I think, for the United States, who's still a young team. I mean, we've talked about, you know, flipping the page from the Olympics a lot and trying to build this younger group in, and it's going to take some time. So I see actually England as the favorites for this one still. But as we know, when you're playing the World Cup champion against the European reigning champion, I think it's going to be a great game at a sold out Wembley Stadium. I'm jealous we don't have it on our air. It's on Fox.
Well, what about the game? What about the Spain game?
Yes.
You think they're favorites there, or are they underdogs there too?
I do think that the U.S. is favorites against Spain. And there was a public disclosure of some of the tension that's happening. I think that was supposed to stay behind the scenes, or the players had hoped would stay behind the scenes. And the Spanish Federation came out saying that 15 players have demanded that Jorge Vilda, our coach, resign, or they're not going to play. And we are not taking that demand. And of course, the players have pushed back on that, saying we did not demand that. We've demanded that there be some changes, some professionalization of this team. Alexis Putellas, who, of course, is the Ballon d'Or winner and star of the team, is injured. She wasn't one of the 15 because she isn't part of the roster right now with her ACL injury, but she is in support of it. Irene Paredes, another star player, wasn't part of that 15. She's apparently reportedly on board with the players as well. So this is going to be interesting because the roster, which comes out tomorrow for Spain, is going to be a very different one. It will be largely, I think, youth players. But having said that, this youth national team for Spain, current under 17 World Cup champions, current under 20 World Cup champions. They've had so much success at the youth national team level for Spain on the world stage. We've known this for a very long time that their youth movement is strong. So it's still going to be a big challenge for the United States.
Yep. Should be a fascinating week for the U.S. women's national team. England on October 7th, Spain on October 11th. Julie Foudy, thanks so much for joining us here on Football Americas.
Miss you guys.
There she is, Julie Foudy. We'll be on the call together. Spain against the U.S. next Tuesday, October 11th. Coverage starts 2:30 p.m. Eastern Time on ESPN2 and streaming live on the ESPN app. All right, time for our parting shot here, Herc. It's the end of an era. FIFA 23, the video game, is out, and it's the last of its kind. From next year on, it'll be known as EA Sports FC after a licensing battle. Herc, that's kind of sad.
Yeah, tomorrow's the last day. You know what's sad? It's a game that everybody grew up with. It's a game that brought a lot of my friends together that weren't even soccer fans. People that I know who don't even like soccer play FIFA. They love it, and now it's all coming to an end. Very fortunate enough to actually be in the game. One of the greatest thrills of my life was seeing myself, little digital character, playing his little digital heart out on my console. So that was pretty cool, but you shall be missed.
What was your pace?
Oh, no, pace and shot were money, my man. Yeah, these kids have nothing on me.
Okay, we got to get Herc's FIFA player card for a future reference here on Football Americas. All right, that's it for this edition of the show. We will be back on Monday with a full look ahead to the Liga MX playoffs. We've also got a USA England week when it comes to the women's game. And Herc, what do you got in your hand there?
This is a telly. Just want to say thank you to you for watching us. This is for you. And thank you to production. Production, yes, who works tireless hours to give you that great content. It just isn't this beautiful face and that little pretty little guy to my right over there.
All we do here at Football Americas is hang banners. There you see it. The first of many in Hercules' hand. He's Herc. I'm Seth. Thanks for watching. We'll see you on Monday on the next edition of the show.
That's the name of my book that's coming out. Take that, Christian.